Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Traction Pieces Podcast, episode 271. Thank you all for tuning in, guys. I'm joined today by Nick Helm, and I was really pleased, as you'll hear, I was pleased to have this one, because me and Nick had only met briefly years ago now, but I've always been a big fan of his work, so it was good to properly get to sit down and chat. Before we get into it, I'll mention two things. We've just had Poem of the Month over at patreon.com/scroobiuspip. As Nick is a poet and musician himself and comedian and everything else, I thought I'd mention that now. It's a dollar a month, or you can pay more, but it's a minimum of a dollar a month. And you get Poem of the Month recording from me. You get Distraction Pieces Rewind. You get previews of upcoming guests, all sorts of stuff like that. Also, head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com for all your summer goods. We've got loads of good stuff there. I'm going to keep this intro brief because we have a really good chat. We talked for a long time at the start about something that none of you have asked us to talk about, but we thoroughly enjoy it, so hope that's okay. I did similar with Ed Gamble, and it went down really well. Me and Ed, when Ed was on, we talked about metal and new metal for about half hour at the start. And me and Nick do a similar thing here. Previous guests, if you're tuning in for the first time, I've had people like Ed Gamble, I've had James Acaster, comedians Stuart Lee, Josie Long, Catherine Ryan, Sarah Pascoe, Ashlyn B, loads of good comedians over the years. So check them all out. Ramesh Ranganathan, Jamali Maddox. Who else can I think of? There's been loads, I promise you. Gaz Khan, everyone. Anyway, let's just get on with the podcast. I should mention that this week, Pod Bible issue 3 launched. Pod Bible is a podcast magazine that I do with Stuart Whiffin and Adam Richardson. It's really good. There's places that you can get a physical copy. They've kind of become collector's items, but you can read the digital copies at podbiblemag.com. So, and follow us on all the socials, all under Pod Bible, on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all that kind of thing. So come hang out there. But for now, this is episode 271 of the Distraction Pieces Podcast with the wonderful Nick Helm. Right, I'm joined today by Nick Helm. How are you, sir?
I'm all right, thank you very much.
Good. We're in the Hoxton Bar and Kitchen, which is a nice chilled location, right?
Yeah, I think that I was around this area a few weeks ago, but I wasn't in this bar.
Right.
That's a little behind the magic curtain.
Were you out partying in glorious Hoxton?
I was out, but it wasn't really partying. I was out with a friend, and it got messy and late, but we weren't into it. I think we met like about 10, and I was like, sure. And then I'll have a couple of drinks, and then I'll be, but I can't stay out too late. And then we were getting kicked out at 4 o'clock. It's like, oh, right, okay.
I do a club night up the road, and I was on my way home from it one night, and I'd left about half an hour to an hour before it closed. Because I had to get back to Essex. And I'd been there all night, so I'd put in my work. And I was on my way home, and a mate of mine rung me. He was like, fuck's sake. And I was like, what? He's like, I've been kicked out of your club. I was like, why? What did you do? Like, I can ring someone, maybe? He's like, I don't know. They just kicked me out, blah, blah, blah. And I looked at the clock. I was like, it's closed, Rob. You've not been kicked out. It's just closed. He had no idea that the music had stopped and the lights had come back on. Just like, them pricks have kicked me out. I was obviously having too much fun. I was like, no, it's just night's closed, Rob. That's it. It's time to go home now. We were going to record this a week or so ago, and it fell through. And I was going to dig you out about it loads on the podcast for comedy value, but I'm not. It's all good.
Sure.
It was just poor timing. But one of the things I thought we could start with, at that point, I think it wouldn't have been a good time to talk about it because it hadn't all sunk in. But at that point, I'd just watched Endgame.
Oh, right.
And I'd seen that I saw a tweet from you, I think, the day before I went to see it. And I was like, oh, I don't want to look at that.
Yeah.
Are you a big film fan?
I'm a big film fan.
Let's talk about films for a bit. And then we'll get into the business side of things.
Sure, okay. Well, I've been thinking about it a lot recently. I'm a really big film fan. I'm not a really big TV... Not like I'm not a big TV fan. I will watch TV, but I will watch stuff like Great British Menu, right?
Yeah, yeah,
where you have a heat a week and it builds to a thing and then it's over. Mm-hmm. And if you miss an episode, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, you can start again on the next season.
And I wasn't really... I've watched the first one and a half series of Game of... I watched it until my friend Gemma Whelan gets fingered on a horse.
Right.
And then I was just like, it's not going to get better than this. So I stopped watching. And set by her brother. And so I watched it up until then. And then that was just like, right, I've seen Gemma. And then I like had a break. Maybe I was writing a show or something like that.
Yeah.
And I just never got back to it. And then it's got to the point now where even that was kind of like about season five was out already and I had to start it. And now it's got to a point where everyone's going on and on about Game of Thrones. It's, like, it's such a commitment.
It's just overwhelming, isn't it?
And it's like, it's not just about like catching up. It's like you've got to start it from scratch and have the same conversations that people have been having for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, if you watch a film, it's 2 hours and then you've seen it. And I think I like the fact that because I'm busy, and I'm not so busy, but because I'm busy, I can watch it and then my commitment to that thing is done.
Yeah.
And then if I really like it, I can watch other things that that director or that actor has seen.
Yeah. Because the Marvel films have kind of been a TV show in film
form.
That's
how I feel.
In the end game, you can just watch it on its own, but really, you're going to... I can see that people who haven't watched all the others are going to go, oh, I fucking can't be bothered to start with. I've got 22 films to watch.
I think I've watched them all as they've come out.
Same.
I've not really loved any of them, but I've not hated... I think I hated Doctor Strange, but I've not hated really any of them.
Yes.
And they've got some that are less, you know, they feel like smaller films than others, like Ant-Man.
Yeah.
You know, that feels like almost like a standalone thing. But I don't love any of them. And I don't hate any of them, and I don't rewatch any of them.
Yeah.
And I've always like equated it to like EastEnders, where you go, I'm not gonna. They just keep churning them out, and they team, and there is a storyline for each film.
Yeah.
But the success of that film has no bearing on whether they're going to make another one.
No. Yeah, that's a great point.
And so they're all just trailers for the next film. And so I think that when I went to see Infinity War, that was the only one of them that felt like a real... And I really loved Spider-Man, but that was kind of like half Sony.
Yeah.
So Infinity War felt like a huge like event film, and it's the only one that I've considered really thinking about watching it. My other one that I really liked was Thor The Dark World, which no one
likes.
Everyone hates that one. But I think the thing I like most about that is when he's on the underground.
Yes.
And you go, and maybe that's the only bit I remember from it.
I mean, he gets it wrong, doesn't he? I'm sure I remember him on the underground, and he says like it's too stuck. Like there was some annoying
inaccuracy.
And I was like, man, that's it's so easy to have
sloppy,
got that right.
Just sloppy. and I like the actors as well, but with Infinity War, I thought that felt like an event film, and then I missed Captain Marvel because I was working, and then. This new one, Endgame. I really liked it.
Yeah.
It's probably my second favourite Avenger, you know, out of all of the Marvel movies.
Yeah.
But it's those two, and then a huge gap.
Yeah.
And then I was really impressed that they got so many cast members back together.
Yeah. And just the scope of, I think I was almost as excited when afterwards I saw an Instagram post from Chris Pratt, and it was just he'd done a little video on set one day, which he shouldn't have done.
And
it really hit in how big all these are. Because you're watching it, and because it's so fantastical, you forget that real people were doing...
Yeah.
You forget that that was all of these huge stars. And for that last battle scene is the bit he's filming a bit of. And it's all green screen or whatever, but he does pan along and you've got Chris Hemsworth and Paul Rudd.
I just assumed that they'd have all added them together in post-production.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? It's just like when they do the... are we doing spoilers?
Well, we'll do spoilers. Yeah, go.
All right, spoilers. But when they do the funeral scene at the end and it pans through and it's got everyone, you could digitally composite
Completely.
Them together.
Yeah.
But because it's sort of like on a real location, you just take it for granted that they're all there.
Yeah.
But with the fights, you just go...
None of
it doesn't
real.
Really impress me that they got everyone together, because you go, what a waste of time.
What
you might as well just film them all separately and put them together afterwards. Do you know what I mean?
That was my reaction to a few things. I watched that, is it Love, Sex and Robots or something? Love, or Death, Sex and Robots or something. It was a Netflix thing, and it was a series of different animations, all kind of put together by director Fincher.
David Fincher?
Yeah, yeah. And he'd put the project together, and it was all these shorts of these amazing animations. And there was a few of them that I was like, it's amazing, but this would have been a lot easier to just film a person do that. Yeah. Like a few of them that just made these people and made this location. It's
right,
like,
right.
That would have taken an hour if you'd just gone there. This has probably taken a month to make this fictional version. It's exactly that kind of similar thing. It's like, you didn't really need to do that, did you? This feels a bit much.
Yeah, it's showing off.
Yeah, it's fascinating, that point on the Marvel things of how it is like an EastEnders thing, because there's no genuine consequence, because from a fair way in, they were making the next film, or the next film's already made. Because there's a lot of them I've really enjoyed. I'm a fan, but exactly as you said there, I've not really rewatched any of them. A few of them I've put on to rewatch because they're on, and I've not finished it.
Yeah.
So it's been exciting for that. I need to know what happened. But effectively, I probably could have got almost as much on some of them from just reading what happened.
But I don't know how much of that is now because I'm older, we're older. Because I remember watching like Superman 3 with Richard Pryor. Like, I've seen that like 20 times.
Yeah.
And I grew up on those films, and they're like favourites of mine. I'll watch them over and over again. And, you know, Tim Burton's first two Batman films.
Yeah.
You know, I watch them over. And even something more recent like The Dark Knight, I've watched a few times. But with the Marvel films, it's kind of weird how there's, I don't know, they all feel, they've all been kind of like, what I'll say in favour of the DC films, which have sort of, the last few haven't been very good. They've got a, well, hang on. So this is quite complicated, because what they do is, when they hired someone like Tim Burton, they had like a visionary director to take over what they did. And it was the Batman films were less Batman films and more Tim Burton films.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
And then when Joel Schumacher took over, he kind of made them into kind of like, they were Warner Brothers movies. He was basically trying to sell toys for them. So when Christopher Nolan took back, they became Christopher Nolan movies. And then when Zack Snyder took over, they became sort of Zack Snyder movies. And then something happened with like Suicide Squad, where Marvel were doing so well by that point. They were just like, well, let's make Suicide Squad more like a Marvel movie. And then the sort of, I think it was David Ayers that did that, and he'd already done like a few sort of gritty movies.
Mm.
So they took it kind of like further away from like the director's control and more into like a corporate thing.
Yeah.
But what the difference between what you could say in favour of the DC films is that in the past they've always had very kind of like clear visioned directors that were in charge of them, and with the Marvel films, they've all got to kind of like feel like the same thing.
Yeah. I think that's possibly down to the fact that it seems like Marvel, as you say, seem to have had a plan for 20 films or whatever, and that's been executed, whereas DC have always seemed a bit more, oh, what should we do next? Okay, let's do this.
I think when they started with Marvel, they were kind of like a little bit, I guess they got Jon Favreau in to do Iron Man, and they were like, Jon Favreau, he did Swingers, he's kind of like good at sort of like sassy, smart-talking guys, and we've got Tony Stark, and we'll put them together with Robert Downey Jr., and they'll create something really special. And then I think the next one was Captain America, we'll get Joe Johnston, he did The Rocketeer, and he's good with special effects, so he's done period action movies, and he's good with special effects, he did Jurassic Park 3.
Perfect.
So we'll get him in, he was a perfect fit, and it felt like a Joe Johnston film. And then you get Thor the Dark World, it's sort of Asgardian, so we'll get Kenneth Branagh, you go, no, because he's done Shakespeare, and you go, Shakespeare is in the dialogue, but it's still an action film, and Kenneth Branagh wasn't really that familiar with action films.
Yeah.
And so then it was kind of like, oh, hang on a minute, well, maybe we'll pull back on getting these, and really what we want, if we want to get all the films to kind of like feel like they're all in the same universe.
Yeah.
But we'll give them slight flavours of what that director could bring. You know, like Edgar Wright got taken off Ant-Man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And replaced with someone that, you know, that's going to do sort of more like what
a Marvel film
is.
yeah
but Kevin Feige is the guy, and so I think that when you get to the end, you've watched all of the Avengers movies, you've watched all 22 movies, and you go, I think that when you look at them as individual parts, they can be underwhelming, but when you look at it as the work of Kevin Feige or Kevin Feige,
I've heard Feige recently. I assumed it was Feige.
When you look at like the complete body of all of that, when you look at Kevin's work, right, you go, that is actually an absolute miraculous achievement.
A unique achievement. Never been anything like it.
And you can forgive the weaker entries, you know?
Yeah.
Because this guy has basically orchestrated all of the, like, huge stars. Robert Redford, Michael Douglas, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer. He got Michelle Pfeiffer basically out of retirement. And you go, you know, and then he's introduced people to new people. He's reinvigorated Robert Downey Jr.'s career. It's like he's done so much for all of these, you know. I'm not like saying he's done so much for people like he's done, but they have done loads of charity work on top of that. But I'm not like saying it in terms of that. But in terms of like reinvigorating a huge section of the movie making industry, or specifically Hollywood, then he's done this incredible thing that's cross-generational for not only the people involved, but the people that are like fans of it. I just think that that's sort of... Yeah, so it is an achievement, even though they're all one watches.
It also meant it had to be the biggest film of all time, because people had committed to so much over the years. It's like, you're not going to... If you're watching a TV series, it's unlikely you're going to get to the last episode and go, I don't think I'm really into this.
Yeah, right.
It's like, it had to be. Like, everyone was like, it's destroyed all box office records. It's like, well, yeah.
But how many people...
It's been a 21-film marketing campaign. As you said, it's been 21 trailers for this thing.
But also, it's just kind of like... And they're going to keep making them.
Yeah.
But it just feels like, this is over for me.
Yeah.
I remember when I went to see Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah.
And I saw it on definitely the week it came out, if not the day. But it was a really early morning screening, like a 5:30 screening. Yeah. And I just remember coming out of Revenge of the Sith, and I was just like, oh, thank you, George. I never have to spend another penny on Star Wars ever again.
I'm going
to
leave it there.
You've ended it for me, you know what I mean? And with this, it's just kind of like, it just feels like it's nicely kind of like landed, and I don't really need to bother with it anymore. But
I don't know if I want to start on the next journey, because it's another 10 years of one watches.
Because this is like the biggest... box office, it's 2 billion already, and it's been out for a fortnight.
Yeah,
and so there must be people that are watching it that haven't seen any of the others,
yeah,
that have been dragged along. But then, what do you think about this film in comparison to the last one? Because Age of Ultron, the Infinity War.
Yeah, I think exactly right that both of them felt like huge events. They felt like there was so much in every scene that. It hid the running time. The fact that they're both 3-hour-long films. I didn't think it felt like that at all. I thought every scene they just packed it all in so well. And I think I enjoyed Endgame more because of that feeling of completion.
Yeah.
I think the drama at the end of Infinity Wars would have been great if I didn't exist in the real world. Because in the real world, I was aware that Black Panther has just had a huge film. There's going to be a series.
They're not killing him off.
Guardians at that point were signed for a third one, and all this. It's like everyone that died, it was like, right, well, they're definitely not. Do you know what I mean? So, if I didn't live in the real world and have stupid real world influences on there, that would have been, oh my God, this is amazing. But there was, oh my God, I wonder how they're going to solve that.
That's quite interesting, isn't it? Because in actual fact, everyone that died in the snap at the end of the last one, they came back. And then the people that survived, which was. You know, Iron Man and
Cap,
Black Widow.
Yep, Scarlet
Johansson.
Black Widow.
And because there's Scarlet Witch as well, isn't there?
Yep.
Which is played by someone else.
Yes.
But Scarlet Johansson plays Black Widow.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was only really like 5 people that could die.
Yeah.
I thought they handled Captain America. Like, Captain America is quite a boring character,
mm-hmm.
and I thought it was a real achievement that he was basically the best character in this film.
100%.
There's like 70 main characters.
And the simple him addressing of his boringness cunning love of when he fights himself. He's like, I could do this for hours. He's like, I know. It's like the kind of acknowledgement of God. Yeah. If you're not me, I must be really annoying.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought they did great with that. And I think this isn't a Marvel podcast, and we will move on after this.
Two people that aren't that fussed about Marvel movies.
They're both going, yeah, it's all right. But I love the way they've reinvigorated Thor, because I do think I really enjoyed the first two Thor films, but partly because as a comic book fan, I felt they were the most impossible to make good.
Yeah,
because it's so silly.
Yeah,
it's gods. It's all this, and I thought they did it great. But then as soon as Ragnarok happened, and they kind of reinvented him as this wisecracking comedy character. Yeah, I loved it, and he was the other one in this that I was like, yeah. He's gold.
I think Chris Hemsworth's great, and Chris Evans, and Chris Pratt.
Yeah,
all the Chris's.
All the Chris's. Yeah. They got all the Chris's and none of the Ryans. Right. So they didn't get a Gosling, a Reynolds. There's another one. There's another good Ryan, sexy Ryan. I can't think. But basically, it's Ryans and Chris's. It depends who you go for. The Ryans or the Chris's. Yeah. And they went for all the Chris's.
And that's they did well. Out of the three Chris Evans as well.
Exactly. The collection of Chris Evanses. Shall we talk about something other than Marvel films?
Sure.
As far as I remember, we first met at the Fringe.
Yes.
And it's the one year I did the Fringe,
which was 2013.
Yeah, I'd say 12 or 13.
Yeah. I think it was 12 because I didn't have any merchandise back then.
Yes. And that was it. I was a fan of you already. And I was always excited at the Fringe. Anytime, it's going to sound stupid, but anytime comedians came along or were there for my show, because I'm doing spoken word and stuff, and I've written some comedy into it, but I'm a huge comedy fan. So it was exciting anytime I'd say, like, a comedian's actually come to mind. And you came up to me at the merch booth and asked me about merch, because it was a weird thing. I've come from years of touring with music, and we do merch constantly.
Yeah.
But in comedy, particularly The Fringe, it's not that common a thing.
It's not. And also, I think that it can feel a little bit grubby.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's just like, thanks for coming to see my show. Now, I think it's, you're the face of it. You've got nowhere to hide behind. Yeah. You're literally saying, this is how much it is, and you're going to pay me that.
Yeah.
And then they give you your money, and there's a bit of you in the back of your head that's going, oh, give it you for half price. You're sort of like ashamed of having to ask, charging, not having to ask, but you're ashamed of charging the money. But then at the end of the day, you go, that's what it's worth.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I think it's interesting because I think merch became such a lifeblood in music, more so than in comedy, because you previously make money in music from selling music, and then digital just killed that, so you'd have live and you'd have merch to try and make that work. So whereas comedy, you do your live and then you hopefully make off of that, and then hopefully make off of a show, a tour, a TV thing. So I think it was a weird one, because I spoke to a few comedians that year who had a similar thing, because you said exactly that. You're like, how do you make this work? Is it comfortable? Does it not feel weird to be stood here after you've done your thing going, all right, can I have some money for this? You know, but again, it's the mindset, I guess. It's getting comfortable with the fact. It's like, no, the merch is stuff I've worked hard on as well, and it's got its own value, and I'm proud of. So
So I've got two albums. I'm working on a third album, and you spend hours and hours into that, and it costs money to make music as well.
Completely.
And so you do all that, and then at the end of it, you know, you do a tour, but then the tour is also a really great way of like connecting with your fans and meeting your fans, and you know, and a lot of the time they just want to meet you or sign stuff. And so I always say, you know, you don't have to buy anything. I'll sign a flyer, I'll sign a ticket, I'll do anything. And then you stand there and you just meet so many people, and that, I think I heard this from Stuart Lee when he was talking about merchandise, but basically a lot of the time they just want something to take away.
Yeah.
And then you meet them, you sign it, they take it away, and then they've got that, and it's like a memory of that night. And I think it sort of like solidifies that event for them.
Yeah, I'm the same. I remember from going to gigs myself and being blown away that the artist was doing the merch and buying albums I've already got because I want a signed one.
Yeah,
it,
right.
It means something. That it's a memory of that night. I remember because all through my music career, I'd run my own merch booth and we'd be doing like Coco to 2,000 people and I'd be crammed in this merch booth at the end. And one person outside once was saying to Dan Lesak, oh, it's just money grabbing, isn't it? You know that, or Pip knows if he's doing the merch booth, you're going to sell more merch. It's like, these things don't have to be mutually exclusive. I do know that, but also I know that it means a lot to people to come and say hello and have a photo, particularly photos now for Instagram or whatever else.
Absolutely.
Have a photo, have something signed. It's like, it can be both. It does mean we're going to sell more, but also it means everyone who comes to the booth is going to have a better memory of the night, a bigger moment and a shared thing.
And you give everyone a bit of your time. Do you know what I mean? Kind of like it's. I think that when I in 2012 when I met you, I came up because I was interested in sort of making some albums and doing some stuff, but I didn't really know how to go about it. And the one thing, I'm quite shy. And I'm very kind of like introverted a lot of the time, and I honestly couldn't imagine anything worse. And also, I've got like nightmare memories of my parents taking me to car boot sales, where people were like clawing through the boot before you got out of the car, and you know, it was just kind of like, I just couldn't imagine like anything really worse in terms of that. And then the moment I did it, I always remember that bit in Spinal Tap when they're in the record store and nobody's turned up and. Derek Smalls is blowing his nose and it's like really bleak.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking, well, that'll be me.
Yeah.
And then the moment I started doing it, I did it, I think my first album came out in 2013. So I was doing Edinburgh and I just set up a trestle table at the end of the gig.
Yeah.
And people started queuing around the block and it was like, oh, this is great. And then you meet them all.
Why wasn't I doing this?
Why haven't I been doing this for longer? And you meet them all and it's kind of, yeah, I love it. And
it's funny because I'm similar in that way. In that, like at the Fringe, for example, I one of the few people I know up there was a Brett Goldstein, and he was like, I was like, I'm not really going to be partying much. I've got some writing I need to do, and he was like, as soon as you're up there, that will change. But I'm just not a social person. Yeah. I had like two or three nights out the whole time I was up there. So the merch booth is also a nice bit of post-show socialising, as weird as it sounds,
because
I'm not naturally that person. It's really nice to have all these people. And again, it's a skewed socialising. You know you're going to generally meet people who think that you're great, which is a lovely way to skew your socialising. But I found it a really cathartic way to end each show, to have a bit of interaction and then go back and be a weirdo in my apartment or whatever it is,
dungeon,
in my flat, or dungeon.
But I think that's another thing as well, isn't it? It's like so much of the feedback that we get now is online, and it's anonymous and it's faceless. And in actual fact, it's nice to actually see. And there's a lot of horrible things that get said about people. And I think it's nice to actually go out. And some of it's ego fanning, surely, but I think it's nice to actually go out and get a response from people and to be able to. I did a show 2 years ago that was about depression and suicide, and it was a comedy show. And I think that at the end, I was able to sort of like talk to, you know, some people came up to me and said, "Well, you know, what do you mean, like making fun of stuff like this and making?" And I said, "Well, I don't think I wrote jokes about my experiences within that, but I don't think I was making fun about that stuff." And then you get to talk to people and kind of like sort of discuss what you've done, and it's sort of like it's made me very much more aware of how some of the stuff that I say can be taken out of context and can be kind of like misunderstood.
Yeah,
it's maybe a bit more, not more careful, because I think that show, I stand by that show. I think it was a really it was a really personal show, and I think that if I felt it and I've experienced it, then it's fair game and I can write about it.
I couldn't agree more. Weirdly, literally on the same night I spoke to you at the Fringe, it's weird, it's a memorable night, because I said I knew of your stuff, so it was good to chat briefly, but I had a girl come up who was really angry with part of my set, and it was awkward because, again, there is a queue of people there, and she was like, I don't think you should have been talking about, I think it was suicide in that way, because I do a piece about suicide and then I make a joke about it afterwards, and the point of everything in that show was to have jokes and then hit hard with the seriousness. So kind of a spoonful of sugar, but also kind of really heighten the impact of the serious stuff. And she wasn't happy with it. And I didn't know what else to say. I was like, all right, I'm sorry. And we had a quick chat. And I was like, well, exactly as you said there, the stuff I've talked about there is stuff that I went through and I experienced. So I feel I have a right to talk about it in however I see appropriate. That's how I'm dealing with it. And she was like, well, no, that's wrong. You shouldn't. And I was like, I don't know what to do now. Particularly, again, as weird as it sounds, the strange pressure of a queue full of smiling people and an angry person now. I was like, I mean, we can talk more afterwards. I don't know if we're going to have much more to say because you don't agree and I do.
Yeah.
And it was exactly that. It was like, but again, it's good to have those things to, in a way, to test your resolve on these things. So you also can go, oh, am I right or am I playing
it too
lightly?
Yeah, to clarify your approach to stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
Because even if you're stubborn in the moment to defend it, you're going to go home and think about it and go, was I defending it because I'm stubborn or was I defending it because I believe that?
But I think if you're working on new stuff, it's very, you know, it's difficult to know. You might, like, the landing might not stick, do you know what I mean? You might have approached the subject matter in maybe the wrong way, maybe you're a bit heavy-handed. But once you've sort of, like, worked on it and thought about it and you've really kind of, like, developed it, by the time it's the final thing, you know why it's there.
Yeah.
You know why you've put it in there and you know what purpose it has as part of that show. I think a lot of people with comedy is slightly different, but, like, I think, well, it's not... I think people go for a night out.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's your responsibility to ruin that person's night out.
Yeah.
But I also think that I have, because of the subject matter that I deal with, and I've always dealt with depression in terms of what I say on stage. And it started off, I've just been thinking about it because I'm writing my new show. And in the early days, it was kind of like, I just want to get a laugh. So you'd write a one-liner about your depression.
Yeah.
I used to say something about, you know, I've always suffered depression. It's not the big things like war and famine and disease that gets me down. It's the little things like when you get home and you realise you've got to change your own duvet case by yourself. Right?
Yeah.
And that's true, but it was a one-liner. Yeah. I didn't scratch beneath the surface of depression anymore than I've got a joke.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I see.
And now I've got to a point where I'm standing on stage and the discussion comes first. And then if I can make that humorous, then that's a bonus.
Mm.
And I think that it's my... I mean, I'm just starting... I've just started writing this show. And I think a lot of my fans and a lot of people that return to come and see me do also suffer from those things. And it's not... I think it's cathartic. It's cathartic for me and it's cathartic for them to hear somebody talking about those feelings.
Yeah.
And it's also important to remind people that no matter how bad you're feeling... you're not alone.
Yeah.
And to have somebody come up on stage and talk about their own experience with it,
yeah,
is good. It's good for people. And I think that sometimes it might not be someone else's idea of a good night out.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make it any less valid.
Completely understand. Yeah. Yeah. And again, it doesn't mean if you removed everything that might make someone feel uncomfortable or not see as a good night out, then so much stuff would be buried. It's important to have challenging topics and subjects in those places.
And I also don't think talking about depression has to be morbid.
No.
I don't think talking about death has to be morbid. I think that
I've made a career of talking about death, and only when I started to get coverage did I realise that people saw it as morbid. It just hadn't occurred to me. It's just something that my family's always been very open about death and stuff like that. So it would come into a lot of my songs and stuff. And then people would be, oh, it's all quite dark and morbid. I'd be like, what? Is it? I thought we were just having a conversation. I didn't... And again, I completely agree. These things, the more they're discussed, the more... Because death, 100%, and the stats on mental health, depression, a fair decent percent, we're all going to experience it.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally, we're all going to experience death, and a lot of us are going to have some kind of mental health struggles. So it's bizarre to see that as things that we can't talk about or shouldn't talk about or feel uncomfortable talking about, because it's the things that link all of us.
Yeah, and I absolutely. I think that there's a lot. When you look at like mainstream comedy, a lot of that is sort of like aspirational, and it's kind of like nice shiny suit, big stage, telling jokes, and I think that's great. That's definitely a way. It's definitely a way to approach it. But then I also think that when you take that veneer off and you sort of like just starting to relate as a human being, then you're being more honest. I also think there's a difference between getting any, what your target is. What is your target? If you're punching down, then that turns me off. I'm not interested. But if you're kind of like building bridges and you're trying to sort of like relate to other people, then that's kind of what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
But when you do talk about depression, and when you do talk about suicide, and when you do talk about, issues that have affected people in a really painful way, and you surround that with laughs and jokes, I think that you can hear a word. It's a trigger word, isn't it? And you hear the word, and you don't, regardless of the context, you think, right, well, they're making fun of this subject.
Yeah, yeah.
And in actual fact, when I went on tour, I've only been on one national tour, which was 2017. And when I did that, I met so many people, and there was like two or three people that came up and they wanted to talk to me afterwards about it seriously. And their opinions are valid, but it gives you the opportunity to sort of like correct that and to discuss that with them and learn from them, but also get your point across. And then you meet, hundreds of other people that kind of like, it hasn't affected, and then you meet a whole proportion of your audience that it has directly affected, and they're kind of like, they needed to hear something said out loud by someone.
Completely. And the amount of people that can reach in a truly personal way is fantastic. Even though you're only talking about your experiences, it can really make such a connection and make such a...
Yeah, I've always thought that about comedy. I always think that the moment I've tried to write for an audience, it's never been as satisfying.
Yeah.
I think I haven't done Edinburgh, like a full run at Edinburgh, since 2013. So for 6 years. And my last show was kind of like, I was going to give up and I was going to stop doing Edinburgh. My first Edinburgh was a school play in 97.
Wow.
And then I started writing shows in 2001. And I've pretty much done every year since 2001.
Wow.
And I got to 2010. So I did 9 years of writing Edinburgh shows. No one was coming to see me.
Yeah.
And I got to 2010. I was going, right, this is going to be my last year. And then that was the year that, Daniel Kitson came to see me, Jimmy Carr came to see me, they started tweeting about me, and then all of a sudden I went on Russell Hell's Good News, and then all of a sudden I had like this career.
Yeah.
And then I did 2011, 2012, 2013, and those were like, those three shows were back to back, but they became less and less personal and more about, I've got to do Edinburgh again.
Yeah.
And
I've got a profile and a demand now rather than I've got a show.
Yeah, absolutely. And those shows were good shows.
Yeah.
But there was less and less of me in them, and I found it harder and harder to write about it.
Right.
Because I was a persona. I was kind of like a single, lonely, I've just been dumped.
Well, this is one of the things I wanted to kind of discuss with you, because, I mean, it's interesting that you were talking about the nerves of meeting people on the merch booth, and initial nerves, because it's an interesting one, because the times I'd seen you live... It's a character on stage, but more so it's confrontational comedy in a way, or putting people on edge a little. In a similar way, if people only know Johnny Vegas from TV,
then
his live shows, and Doug Stanhope is another one, I'd say that at points you're feeling like is something bad going to happen?
Yeah.
But it's a way of extracting a different kind of reaction, a different kind of laughter, a different kind of relief. And it's amazing. Who was the old American comedian who was a master of it? Sam Kinison was another one that's really... It's such an onslaught that you're not sitting there going...
It's not passive.
The punchline's about to come, and there it is, ha-ha. It's such an onslaught that it's like it gets such an exciting... a reaction, and that's some of my favourite comedy to see. But I can imagine to go from that to being on a merch booth going, all right,
yeah, yeah.
It must be such a strange transition mentally and Yeah, just comfort wise.
Yes, but yes, yeah, I suppose it is. But I've always just thought that, yeah, there's a lot of comedians that want that want you to think that this looks easy.
Yeah,
and I make it look hard. Yeah. and you know, I sweat on stage and I shout for an hour. I mean, these are the old days, but yeah. You know, it's kind of like an exaggerated persona rather than a direct character, but
yeah,
it's yeah, and then you switch that up, and people just come up and they're just like, and they're like, all right, Nick, how you doing? Oh, that, you know, and you're sweating, and they go, oh, you're all sweaty. And you go, yeah, you just saw me on set, and they're just like, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And I think that it's good because it, because I'm not trying to convince people that I am that person,
yeah,
I'm trying to make them laugh for an hour,
yeah,
and at the end. They meet you afterwards, and they're just like, and they know it's an act. Do you know what yeah. I mean? And I think it's very, very much. They know that you're a real person that's doing that. I think that that's a good thing to remind people. I also stand up is one of the things that so like anyone can do it. You know,
right? Yeah.
What I was going to say originally about that was that rather than just going for a laugh, I wanted to make people feel like they'd come off like a roller coaster.
Yeah.
Like, and they feel like. They've got adrenaline in them and energized. So yeah. Definitely in 2011, that show when people were coming out, they in a group of, you know, I used to give out ponchos because I sweated so much, and it would say I survived, I dared to dream with Nick Helm, and like you'd get when you came off like a water ride, and so that was like a definite. Let's make them feel something other than laughing. I don't know why it's just laughter that you want to get out of a show. You can feel lots of things in a show and that be valid.
I mean, that's an amazing outlook and approach in general, because I think that's a key part to understanding the ups and downs of mental health as well, is I think one of the most damaging things in modern society is that we've built a society where we've painted the picture that the sole goal is happiness.
Yeah,
and happiness is great. I'm not shitting on happiness here, but there's a spectrum of emotions that are really important and can be really positive to live through and to learn. But we've built it so that often people think if I'm not in the happiness place, I'm failing. Yeah. Something's gone wrong. I'm doing something wrong. It's like, well, no, you're a human. You're going to have loads of different parts. Some parts are going to be happiness, but there's going to be loads of different bits. They're not a failure. They're not a mistake. And I think that's great to kind of put that thought to comedy. It's like, right, well, we can get laughter, but there's tons of emotions, and we're having, right, we've got this hour together. This is all we've got. We've got this hour together. Let's try and find more than just laughter. Let's have ups and downs all over the place.
I mean, to be fair, if you didn't make them laugh, you wouldn't be doing your job.
The laughter's a key one. The same as happiness is a key one in some way, but yeah.
But I think
that's where I failed at the Fringe.
When we look at...
I just focused on depressing them.
When you look at... But then I just think that is also it. I rather than dark comedy, I always think of myself as light tragedy.
Yeah,
you know, where you go, it's like
that.
The opposite. But like, also when you look at Edinburgh as a microcosm, you're there for a month and you bump into comedians up there or you bump into performers up there and you go, how are you feeling? And they're like, oh, I'm feeling terrible. Oh, my Fringe is going really badly. And then you see them another day and they're like feeling like, oh, it's great. I had a brilliant show and all that.
Yeah.
But like, when you see people on a bad day, it's important to remember that you're there for a month, you know? And if you had a month in anywhere other than Edinburgh, it would be impossible to believe that you would spend 30 days consistently being happy.
Yeah.
You have ups and downs every single day. Every single hour of every day has, like, complications within it. And when you're up in Edinburgh and you're tired and you're doing a show every day, you kind of feel like maybe it's like you're in a privileged position, or maybe it's like... You see it as like a holiday, or maybe you see it as whatever, but you know, it's kind of like you're there for a month. And so you've got to accept the fact that you're not going to be happy all the time. There are going to be kind of like dips there. Mm. And you forget
any month, right? You forget that it's a regular month.
It's like, it's exactly, because there's so much effort that you put into it and pressure put onto it. And it's like a microcosm where you literally go, this month is like an example of what a year is like or what a lifetime is like.
So
you're going to have good bits and bad bits. And you think because you're up here and you're making the effort that you should be happy, but it's pockets. You know, and it's good to focus on that. The other thing about stand-up is that I think, and performance, is that... anyone can do it, and I think it's good for people to see that I don't know how other people present themselves, but it's good for people to see that I'm just normal. I'm just me. I'm in the bar after the gig. You know, I'm getting my coat on. I'm there. You know, it's not like there's no. I'm at that level where I'm not playing big enough venues where I'm protected from an audience.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of like right in there with people, and I think it's good for people to realise that, you know, if they don't like you, that's fine. You can do it yourself. Yeah. Why don't you go and do it? You know, and if they do like you, that's great. I found before I made a living out of it, I found getting out of the house every day and doing stand up just, you know, cathartic. And
yeah, you've nailed one of the greatest arguments on any criticism these days there. And I've used it tons with the podcast. I'll have someone say, you talk out, like, the two things I have the most is they love the podcast because I let the guests speak and it's a conversation rather than an interview. And the other thing is that I never let anyone speak and I talk over everyone and interrupt them. So it's the two conflicting things. But exactly that. I'm always like, start a podcast, man. Like, and I don't mean it in a snarky, or if you think you can do better. Yeah, yeah. It's like, no, dude, like, literally, genuinely, start a podcast. If you're not enjoying the way I do this, start one. There's so many ways to do it.
I've cobbled together. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
I'd love to hear if you've, you know, yeah, just make it. And that's great on the comedy thing. It's like, if you didn't like it, cool. Go on.
Yeah.
Go and do it the way that you think it should be done.
But that's exactly it. And it's something like, and it's not, it's exactly what you say. It's not about, like, well, you think you could do it
better. Nah.
It's literally, I was like you once, you know. I thought comedy was something that someone else did.
Yeah.
And you watch it.
Yeah.
And you have to sit and watch other people and you go, well, it's not for me or whatever. If you, you know, it's a thing that is free to do.
Yeah.
You know, it's free to write. It's free to experience things and find things funny and write your ideas down. And most of the time, it's free to sort of like get up on stage and perform it, and to work out whether you want to do it. And if it's not that, what if it's something else? You know.
I think you get a greater appreciation of anything as well from getting to know the inner workings of it a little bit. I find with most things that if I've tried something, I can then get more out of it. If you know what I mean, as a viewer, as a watcher, if I've been up on stage or even going on smaller things of. Or from touring at some point, I've tour managed, I've been the driver, I've done every element of that, so I can appreciate a good driver, a good charming, all these other things, and get more out of that. And I think that's a similar thing. If you can, the more you get an understanding of things, the more you get out of them as a viewer as well,
no, absolutely.
As an audience member.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the film Old Boy?
Yeah.
I'm going
the
somewhere
original.
With this. Yeah, yeah, the original. There's
I haven't seen Spike Lee's one.
I didn't think it was bad as everyone said. I quite enjoyed it. But yeah, it wasn't as good as the original.
It was so weird that they did it anyway.
Really odd to do. But the thing I love about that, and again, spoiler alert, the masterpiece line in that is you've spent the whole time wondering why we locked you away and you've not asked why we let you out. And that's the big kind of twist. It's why he's been let out at this point. So, rather than why haven't you been to the Fringe for the last 6 years, why are you returning? Why are you going back with your new Phoenix from the Plains show? Is there a reason? Is there a big burning desire?
I don't think there is a huge reason. I think that...
Framed it as a good question, though, right? I made it all sound all clever and...
But I would say... do you know what? The why haven't I been is the more interesting one.
Because it is an interesting trajectory of slugging away at it for years, and then you got that exposure and it seemed to click, and then you did a few more years and then stopped.
Yeah. I think that I stopped initially because I got busy.
Yeah.
1 year I couldn't... But the thing is, I'm one of the few comedians that actually really loves Edinburgh. I started before I was a comedian. I started before it was very competitive. Like, in 2001... I mean, I saw Al Murray when he was a new act in 1997.
Wow.
I think he was doing his second Edinburgh. He got me up on stage. I was just like, bloody hell, I like being up on stage. And then, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence. It's not a deliberate thing, but I don't think it's a coincidence that like 10 years after that or 12 years after that, I was getting people up on stage.
Yeah.
and doing, like, I even got to do the same venue, the Cabaret Bar in the Pleasances, that Al Murray got me up on stage on. So I've always loved Edinburgh, and then I got busy. And when I was doing, I did the third series of Uncle, we filmed over August, and I got bored at the weekends, and so I phoned up Ryan, and I flew up on a Friday, and I did work in progress over the weekend, and came back and filmed again on Monday. So it's sort of like, it's always been there. I didn't come up at all last year, and then I guess I've missed doing a proper show. I did my tour. I did 2 weeks work in progress in 2017, and it was a really stripped down show, so that I could tour it. That I could, you know, it was me with a microphone and my mate and a guitar, David Trent, my best mate, and so it was a really stripped down show. There was I normally do like big kind of like glitzy bells and whistles. I made this in my garden type shows.
Yeah,
and this was really kind of like really. Kind of stripped down, and I toured it, but it was my first tour, and I realised what I'd done is I hadn't toured the sort of show that I would do.
Right.
I think what I did, I can't remember what year it was, 2015, maybe I did a show called Two Nights Stand at the Grand, where I came up, I was editing my show, Heavy Entertainment for BBC, and I had a weekend off, and I went up, and I did two nights at the Pleasance Grand, and it was like, there were 2 hour like music gigs, basically.
Yeah,
I did like all of my shows and sort of like bits and pieces from greatest hits, and and it was, and I got standing ovations at the end of each night. I was just like, I don't think I've ever worked this hard. At the end of the night, I couldn't stand up straight because of all the adrenaline and my diaphragm, and I'd been singing like for 2 hours, and you know, and I got these two standing ovations, and then on my way back. me and my girlfriend were driving back to London, but we were driving back through Scotland. I think just as we got to the Scottish border, I got sent, I got a 3-star review in the Times. And I was just like, that is literally, you can't do anything more than that. And I got a 3-star review in the Times, and they said, yeah, it was all right, but it's just what he does. And you go, what? And I was like, well, fuck you then, I'm not going to come back. And, so when I did my tour, I did this stripped down show. And everyone was like, oh yeah, that's really good. And people were like, oh, it's so good to see you do a different thing. And it was kind of like, yeah, but it's just stand-up, isn't it? And it felt like everyone, you know, any comedian can do what I did on this. And that's great. And there are comedians that are better at straight stand-up than I am. And I think that what it was I was getting kind of like commended for like conforming.
Mm.
It was like, I do all this stuff with costume changes and songs and poems and like audience participation, all this stuff. And I took most of that out of the show, and they were like going, oh, this is great. It's so interesting to see him do a new direction. It's just like, my new direction is the same as everyone else's direction.
Yeah.
And then I just felt like what I really miss is like doing a show with like a big glitzy number at the top and a finale and a, you know, a character arc and, you know, one line. I didn't do any one-liners in the last show, and it's just like, and one line. And I feel like I wanted to reclaim what it was that made me, me.
I love that, because it feels key to have gone and done that show that didn't feel like you, to know that you're doing the glitzy stuff, because that's you, not as a kind of, oh, I need this distraction or this or that. Because a lot of things, again, in performance, I think you have to figure out what you're doing, because that is you, and what you're doing is a comfort a blanket. Here's the bits that make me feel comfortable. It's all right. I've got this. I'm doing this character. I'm doing this or that. So that sounds perfect, to have gone stripped down, get praised for it, and then go, I don't want to do that. That's not me. I've done the most bare version, and it turns out none of that was hiding or covering myself. It was showing myself. That was putting it all out there and going, no, look, here's all the costume changes, all the glitz and glamour.
And I also really enjoyed the stripped down show, and I think I became a better comedian for it. And I think this show, I've just started previewing it, and I preview without any songs, without any poems. I do like a preview, an hour of stand up. I write the songs separately. And then I slot it all together like Lego bricks. And I've got like an hour of stand-up at the moment, which I'm working on, which I'm really happy with. And you go, with every song I put in, it's another 5 minutes of material I've got to take out.
Yeah.
And so,
right, yeah, it's fascinating.
So I'm kind of like, so I don't really know how this show's going to turn out, but I do know that the intention is to get back to kind of like, and I think it will be a mix. It will be a mix from what I've learned over the last few years. Also, the other reason why I'm doing it is I've just spent 4 years trying to get a TV series made, and you just constantly having to jump through other people's
hoops. Fucking heartbreaking, right? I've had a couple of things in development, and being ignorant to it all, the buzz and excitement. Every time it looks like it's going in an exciting direction, and yeah. then they fucking have that ripped away from you constantly.
Just having to protect yourself by like not getting enthusiastic about anything.
Yeah,
and yeah, I'm completely. I'm writing treatments at the moment. I'm just thinking, what's the point? This will never get made. You know,
it's so weird. I've had to explain this to my girlfriend because I'll get. I've been acting for just over 3 years now. And I'm getting some amazing auditions. It's mind-blowing the opportunities I'm getting. But I won't get excited about any of them because, again, it's exactly that. I now know the industry well enough, so it's not going to happen. You have to think like that, otherwise it will crush you because you'll be thinking every day, I've not heard back. I've not heard back on this, or is this happening?
Yeah, or maybe it's more like you do the audition or you hand in the treatment and then you move on. And
completely that. Yeah,
and it's like handing in an exam, and you go, "Well, I can't change what I've written now, so that's it."
Yeah.
And if you hear anything back, then that's a bonus. But that's also the same with, you know, going for a job interview or anything like that. It's kind of like, I think what I tend to do is I allow myself an afternoon of the fantasy of going, "Well, what if I did get the job?" And I go, and then you just,
You see, I find again, it's because I'm new to it all. I get my moments of enjoyment from learning the scene. Because I didn't go to any kind of drama school or anything like this, it's fucking awesome to do these workshops and stuff like that. So I have all the excitement leading up to the audition. I do it, and that's been my... Oh, how lucky am I to get to fuck about play with that. And there's been a few Marvel auditions in there and stuff like that. It's like, oh, that was cool. I was, for that moment... I was in a Marvel film. Yeah, do you know what I mean? And now I walk away from it and forget it and see what comes.
Yeah.
With that, it must be nice to have something that's in your control then to go, right, I'm making a show and I'm going to make this show.
You do, yeah. I mean, you do stand up and you're directing it, you're writing it, you're in it, you know, you're performing it. And you can tweak it, you know, on stage every single... You know this, like, you've got the same material every night, but... the audience steer it in a different way and you maybe need to sort of like hammer some things home a bit more than others. And it's the same material, but it's a different show every night.
Yeah.
And it's immediate and it's exciting and it's not sitting in an office begging someone to let you perform, let you write. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like...
Just let me do this.
You're not even... You spend most of the time... You're not even writing scripts. You're writing... a treatment, which is basically just saying to someone, well, this is what I would write if you will let me.
Yeah.
And I find it really frustrating, and I don't want to be bitter, so I'm choosing to just be productive.
Yeah,
to just get out there and do something that, you know, it's been... I didn't gig for like a year and a half. I'm just getting back into it. I've really missed it. It's good to be doing it again. And also, it's just good to be kind of like in control of my own destiny for a bit.
Yeah, from I found great motivation in script writing from when I had Craig S. Zahler on the podcast, who did Bone Tomahawk and
Dragged Over Concrete,
Dragged Over Concrete, Brawling Cell Block, and it was fascinating to hear from him. That he had like four or five huge scripts that had DiCaprio attached, had Brad Pitt attached, all these things, and they all fell through. But all of those are what gave him a good enough reputation that when he's making Bone Tomahawk, his first film that he's written and directed, he can get all that freedom and control and have these huge names in. And that was a really motivational thing to think that these projects that fail, they've not... failed. They've not gone to where you thought they would go, but they may have opened enough minds or impressed enough people to know that when that final one comes along, they go, no, we know this dude can write, and we, you know what I mean, there's that faith there, and it's all building it. And that was huge for me, because again, I was in that exact point of the first thing I'd written, it got snapped up by Walp. Like, they replied a day after I sent it to them, and I was like, this is amazing, it's going to be filming in a week. And then it hit the usual, the channels aren't biting, it's not right for now. We've already got 10 p.m. shows. It's like, what the fuck is a 10 p.m. show? No one watches anything at times now. And that was a massive one for me to see his career and know that. I mean, painful as well, because you have to look at, he had 10 years or so of being on the cusp of all of his dreams coming true.
Oh yeah, but we've all been 10 years on the cusp of our dreams coming true. But I think the thing about those 10 years is that I don't think they're wasted.
No.
I spent 10 years doing Edinburgh. No one came to see my shows, or if they did, you know, they didn't ever go anywhere. And then as soon as I started doing stand-up, I had like this huge wealth of material and ideas that it was just like, you want an idea? I've got an idea.
Yeah.
You want a poem? I did a poem in this show that I did that, you know. And so you've got all of this kind of like this backlog of material with Bone Tomahawk. That wasn't even his first script. He'd done Bone Tomahawk, that got made, and then he went back and he got Cell Block 99, and he's because they wanted another film quickly, and he went, I've got this one. This was the film that I tried to get made before Bone Tomahawk.
Yeah, it's really
and then
good.
He went out and he brought it out, he did it, and then he made that with Vince Vaughn, and then Vince Vaughn was in his next film after that. It's just kind of like, what you do now and your disappointments now may turn out to be successes later. And I think that, you know, don't throw anything away.
Yeah, it's the preparation thing. I feel like I'm going through the back catalogue of my conversations for motivational moments. But when I had a Winston Duke on, who's in Us and was in Black Panther, and he's amazing, and he was saying he spent years and years of his life preparing for a revolution he didn't know was coming. And this new resurgence of black cinema, of amazing black actors, characters, writers, directors. When he was in film school, he didn't know that was going to happen. Mm. And when he was doing short films, he didn't know that was going to happen. And it just so happens now, all of those years of work means that now that's happened, or is happening, he's suddenly so well equipped. He's put in all the work. He's been preparing for it.
Yeah.
And then it's happened. And it's like, right, I'm the man now. Riz Ahmed was a similar one, speaking to him of just all this studying, and then suddenly when it comes, you're like, right, all that stuff that I thought was flopping or not working, that was all leading me here and all preparing me and putting me in the best position. I'll start to wrap things up. There's tons I wanted to talk about and haven't got around to because we spent an hour talking about Endgame.
Crazy.
You're coming back.
3 stars.
I mean, you're coming back to the Fringe, and it's now there's a massive penny has dropped because you've said that you're one of the few comedians who likes it. Because I'm the same. I talk to comedians and I'm like, it's the best place in the world. There's so much amazing stuff. It's this creative thing, but they're all, it kills you. It's a money pit. But you're returning with a bang because you're also resurrecting your musical, right?
Oh yeah, I wrote a musical 11 years ago.
And
it's the 10th anniversary last year. I wanted to do it last year,
and you
I
did that
it.
When again, I'd imagine no one was particularly turning out.
That's why I'm doing it again. Yeah. Nobody came to see it. And
so it's exactly what we were talking about there. It's like, you need another idea. I've got this from 10 years ago, a fully written musical.
Well, I think like Brett was one of the people that came to see it.
Right, excellent.
And for years he's just said that's the best thing you've ever done.
Wow.
Which you can't help but take that badly.
Yeah.
I've done so much since.
I mean, you've been to a lot, Brett.
You've been to everything, and the thing that no one watched in 2008 was my best thing. So,
do you enjoy tonight, Brett? Do you remember 2008?
I remember 2008. It's no singing and dancing, is it? No, yeah, all right. It was a bit. And it was like, I did it 10 years ago, and I think there was loads of really good things in it. And I basically, I just wanted to kind of like give something another life, you know, and another chance. And yeah, I think it's really good.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Are you excited to get it back out and do it all again?
We're still casting
at the
moment.
Have you had to be preparing?
Am I excited about it? I did it again.
And what is it? Like what kind of?
It's weird. It's not really a musical. It's basically a series of musical vignettes,
right,
based around B-movie horror films.
Amazing.
And they're all like 5 minutes long, and it ends in a 15-minute rock opera, and it's kind of it's called I Think You Stink. And it was originally going to be like a collection of poems and stuff, but then I wrote more songs, so there's like a couple of poems in there, but not really.
And
it's just kind of like, and I did it for Halloween last year for the 10th anniversary, and it was really fun. And then I was just like, do you know what? I'll do that in Edinburgh. I reckon that, and it more so than stand up in a way, it kind of feels like it's perfect for Fringe.
Yeah.
I think that I couldn't tour it. And all the effort that I put into it's got like loads of costumes and props and stuff like that. So I did three nights at Halloween. It's just like, well, I want to do this again because I've put so much effort into it.
Yeah.
You can't tour it. And it's kind of like, well, with stand up, you could do like a weekend of work in progress in Edinburgh and then tour it.
Yeah.
But with this show, it's just kind of like, this belongs in Edinburgh, really.
Yeah.
More so than anything else.
Seems perfect, yeah. Being in the same location night after night. I had to explain Edinburgh to B. Dolan and Sage Francis, who were two rappers who were coming over to do a few... had done 2 years there now, but their initial fear was, well, we've got a decent pull in Scotland, but not enough for like a whole... It's like, oh, no, it's a tour, just the crowd comes to you.
Yeah.
People come from... It's like,
oh, I've never thought of it like
the best
that.
Idea for a tour. It's like, no, you do a tour. You just stay in one place and everyone comes from all over the country. It's like, whoever came up with it is a genius because it means you can do things that maybe you couldn't tour a full musical or whatever until it was huge numbers you can afford to do the full production. If it's in one place, that wipes tons of that out. Mm. So it's completely doable. And yeah...
I've absolutely never thought about it.
Yeah.
God, so,
exactly
so that
is.
Means that my first few Edinburghs, if I think of them as tours, I would have pulled half of the shows.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's amazing.
So, I mean, before we wrap things up, what is the kind of the focus, I guess, going forward? Because you've written a lot and acted in. I loved A Reluctant Landlord, and I thought your character was fantastic in that. So you've acted in stuff that you've not written as well. What is the focus? Are you looking at acting more, writing more, that stand up more, or kind of drifting between it all, or music more? All of
I don't know. I know what I want to do. I mean, so I know what I want to do. I want to write. I never wrote Uncle, which is the thing, which is the misconception.
Right.
And so I've still, I'm at the moment I'm developing my own. Sitcoms and shows and stuff. So I want to do that. I directed a short film that got BAFTA nominated.
Wow, that's fantastic.
So that's the thing that I spent 4 years developing to get into a TV series, which is just really frustrating. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm just at a point now where I'm doing stand-up, which is one of the things that is I find most terrifying. I'm getting back into that. I want to get good at that again. I'm kind of looking forward to the immediate future, which is the stand-up, Edinburgh, the tour, and then after that, I don't know, try and get a film made. I think that's my goal.
It's exciting.
It is exciting, but it's also really unknown.
Yeah.
It's like stepping into outer space.
completely. But again, as you've touched upon, all your experiences up to now are equipping you for your future attempts at these things and the journey it all lead to. So yeah, I look forward to seeing where it all lands.
Well, you too.
Well, thank you very much. It's been an absolute a pleasure. And I'll plug, where can people find the, because after the Fringe, it will be a tour as well,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's so, all over. I think it's all on my website.
Perfect.
Yeah, I think I saw you for the first time in 2010. At the Electric Ballroom in Camden.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, mad.
So it's really nice to, like, and I met you so briefly in 2012.
Yeah.
That, yeah, it's really nice to sit down and talk to you.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much, sir. Cheers.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Nick Helm. I loved talking to him here because the thing that struck me when we met at Edinburgh was how calm and peaceful and reserved he seemed. Having seen his kind of performance persona as such, he's quite loud and confrontational. I love that he's quite a quiet, introverted, contemplative individual. So yeah, go and check out his Fringe show and then the tour afterwards and all that is to come. I'll see you all next week, guys. Who's next week's guest? I should tell. Oh, I think it's a really good one next week. If you've held on right until the end now, I'll tell you. But keep it quiet, you know. Yes, it is. Yes. So next week, I've got Mark Grist and Ross Sutherland. Mark Grist is someone that's been requested a lot. Me and him had a bit of a battle over YouTube videos back in the day. And Ross Sutherland is someone I've known for years who I'm a huge fan of. And we had a really good chat. So that's next week. So until then, this has been the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 271, with Nick Helm. Ta-ta!
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.